This evening, we want to talk a little about the problem of universal law as we find this exemplified in the philosophies of various peoples. There's a considerable amount of conflict in the minds of many devout persons about the concept of law. We so often think of the term on a legal level, associating it with innumerable restrictions and limitations or peculiarities relating to our own cultural platform. We think of law as something found in great books which have to be studied with emphasis upon precedence and upon all the elaborate machinery of human jurisprudence. And because this is law as we have come to know it, the term universal law has some rather unfortunate semantic implications. We think of law perhaps as just, but we are also inclined to suspect that it is cold, that it is something with very little consideration with peculiar problems and necessities of human beings, perhaps broadly protective, but often a frustrating influence upon individuals. Thus, in philosophy and religion, we must have a larger concept of law. We must take away from it this tremendous emphasis upon thou shalt not, which seems so often to be important in a penal code. To the idealistic philosopher, law represents not only the eternal will of the Creator for its creation, but also encloses within its concept and structure the other aspects of the Godhead, namely wisdom and love. Sometimes we think that these principles operate differently. But the wisest of mortals have experienced within themselves the simple fact that universal law is the greatest good, the greatest beauty, the greatest love, the greatest wisdom that man can know. Law does not exist to circumscribe or limit the activity of anything. Law exists to permit and sustain the eternal unfoldment of life. Law is forever protective, and it gives to man one tremendously important psychological security. It tells him that this law will preserve, perfect, protect every creature that is true to it, and that through being true to law, man attains all other good things possible to him, and therefore that a lawful life, a life lived in harmony with law, is a good life, a kind life, a generous life, one thoughtful and filled with understanding. Thus, from fear of law, which was perhaps man's first reaction to the unknown, came respect for law, later admiration, finally love, and perhaps in the highest mystical sense, adoration. Law finally becomes the blazing, living symbol of the divine power itself. And perhaps the very ground of law is its own lawfulness. A law is meaningless if, like mortal statutes, it is subject to innumerable variations, compromises. If we could buy or bribe, universal law. There could be no integrity in our world. Yet from early time, philosophy and religion have been in conflict. Philosophy affirming law, religion constantly seeking to modify law, supplying in its place certain other things: grace, forgiveness, vicarious atonement. Yet actually, whether religion knew it or not, there is no good thing in religion, no promise of spiritual security, no path of life leading to identity with good. But that this security or this path is also part of law. For every quality by which man, through growth and development, can attain to the highest ideals and dreams of spiritual integrity, every ingredient of universal procedure is within law. Now we try to define how we shall understand law. Perhaps we may say that law, universal law, is the divine will in operation. It is this inevitable, perfectly enlightened purpose, this inevitable of the universe fulfilling its own destiny, this absolute sufficiency by which the plan already conceived, sustained, and perfected in the divine consciousness unfolds resolutely and without deviation into the full realization of itself. Thus, we have no recourse beyond law. For if law be the divine will, in what way shall we oppose it? And if it be a manifestation of the divine purpose, by what right do we question it? How can we go beyond that pattern or plan which is the total of ourselves? How can we, as fragments of the infinite, doubt the infinite of which we are the fragment? We have no direction to turn, no place to hide ourselves from the fact of law. Therefore, wisdom has long implied that man's greatest good is a joyous, a consecrated, a voluntary obedience. The law tells us that all disobedience must ultimately be dissolved in obedience, inasmuch as the law itself, being inevitable and irresistible, cannot be indefinitely resisted. Any being or creature may for a time or under a circumstance attempt to violate this law. But the law is greater than he is. Not only is it greater than the individual, but it is greater than the totality of creation. Therefore, in the end, the law bends all things back to itself. It remains the ultimate. And in this recognition and in this acceptance, man realizes that security is in obedience. Insecurity arises from disobedience. Now, disobedience is possible to man because he has an individual mind. But this disobedience does not make him master of the law. He may, through his own ignorance, his carelessness, his indifference, or his forthright antagonism, attempt to set up his own empire, contrary to the empire of space. But space, like a vast ocean, moves relentlessly on its way, dissolving, breaking down, removing every barrier to the fulfillment of itself. As Buddha pointed out, a very great deal of human misery is man forced to stand and watch his own disobedience swept away. He weeps over it. He is miserable about it. It was a pet project of his own. And when it goes, he feels that the bottom is out of the universe. But actually, The law can destroy nothing that is unlawful. The law can be in conflict with nothing, except that which attempts to violate its principles. The wise man has learned also that to live nobly and wisely is to live almost without awareness of law. Law becomes a tremendous dominant force only in the experience of the lawbreaker. To keep the law is to be kept by it, to move serenely without sense of limitation. To violate the law is to feel the heavy displeasure of this opposition, not because the law does not like us, not because it turns revengefully upon an individual, not because it is burdened with a personal jealousy against something, but simply because the law, like water flowing down a mountain, will find its way, must find its way, must keep its own course, and will not tolerate anything that blocks or interferes with that course. This courage and strength and security which law bestows is the natural heritage of every honorable person. And it is only the individual who has some ulterior motive in himself who resents law or regards it as any encroachment upon his own liberty. For all liberty is liberty under law, liberty within the great structure of law. And the greatest liberty man has is the liberty and right of a voluntary personal adjustment by which he can choose immediately to align himself with the great patterns by which the universe is sustained. Thus, with law, we can gradually come into a very friendly relationship. Universal law is, of course, much more than this grand, vast panorama of principles. Universal law is something we use every day. We use it when we cook, when we sew. We use it in business. We use it everywhere. Because if it wasn't for universal law, we could not pour water from a pitcher into a glass. If it was not for universal law, we could not walk upon the surface of the earth. And if it was not for universal law, the seeds that we plant in the earth would not grow and become a harvest. Everything we do, every invention we contrive, every instrument we create is in harmony with law or it will not operate. That is the reason why the Patent Office in Washington now asks for a working model in connection with extremely remarkable, difficult, or unreasonable inventions. Because the proof is, will they work? And they will work only if the inventor found the law governing the device. If he did not, it may be a magnificent work on paper, but it will never operate. Thus, man's existence, his birth, his growth, all these things are possible only because of law. And in the larger moral sphere of our hopes and aspirations, progress depends upon law. Progress depends upon man gradually experiencing law, coming to know it, understand it, and love it. Therefore, everything that we hope for, worth achievement, peace, security, friendship, all these things depend upon the immutable operations of inevitable laws. Thus laws become very near and friendly to us. And we have added to the great pattern of universals many human codes. Most of these codes were originally rather wisely given. The great Babylonian code of Hammurabi is said to have been dictated to the scribes and sages by the god Nebo, keeper of the records of heaven. This primitive code emphasized honesty, right dealings among peoples, fair trade, and a mutual respect, the rights of worship and of citizenship. These things anciently were parts of law, and they were as noble as men could devise them, because men attributed them to the gods. It was only with the increasing confusion of human life, with the rise of individual intellects, the clash of creeds, nationalism, and things of this kind, that gradually laws became more complicated, increasing in number because of lawbreakers. And we have today very complicated statutes, simply because human beings are complicated and resent within themselves many of the simple virtues without which society cannot survive. Some of our laws are good, some are bad, some are indifferent, but they are all products of man's attempt to bring some regulation or order into the conduct of his fellow creatures. And these things are patterned, directly or indirectly, from some concept arising in universals. Now, the ancients recognized a network of laws. And you could carry the study of law as you would carry the study of races or nations or even theologies into most elaborate byways. But they also realized that there was a septenary of laws corresponding to the other great septenaries which they recognized. And like world, universes, deities, continents, these laws forming together a septenary were all manifestations of one law. And therefore, at the root of all life was one tremendous law. Now, this law is interpreted or understood primarily in terms of man's contact with it. The substance of this law, entirely beyond human experience, we do not know. But we know that as far as our reflections, our observations, and our resources permit, that there is a law at the root of things which is constantly causing a perpetual emergence of life. That this law is a law involving the principle of growth, and it has generally been termed the law of evolution. Now, what does evolution mean? Not just in terms of the famous Scopes trial in Tennessee, but in the larger concept. What is evolution? Evolution is the fact of perpetual unfoldment. Evolution is growth. It is the fact that everything moves from its seed and root to the unfoldment of itself. Therefore, evolution is the unfoldment of all things from their natural roots. And it is the unfoldment of the total universe from its own supreme root, deity itself. Evolution is therefore deity moving eternally into manifestation and eternally improving the forms through which it manifests. Evolution is therefore infinite progress, infinitely diversified. It is everything coming of age. Or perhaps in philosophical terms, we can say that the law of evolution is the law of eternal becoming. The end of this, we do not know. That there may be an end, we can postulate. That there may not be an end, we can also postulate. Whether these eternal becomings ever fully become is beyond our knowledge. But the things are always becoming more so, or more complete, bearing fuller witness of their own natures, revealing and releasing continuously more from themselves. This we do know. We know that species are evolving, that human beings between the cradle and the grave pass through not only physical modifications and developments, but also mental, psychological, spiritual, ethical developments. We know that it is the natural instinct of all things to improve, and that this improvement is forever and eternally a release of potential. Thus, evolution is the perpetual release of potential. It is the thing continuously outgrowing itself and reaching towards a greater fullness, a greater maturity. Also, therefore, our term evolution implies the larger concept of ideation, by which we mean that things do not grow from one condition to another, but through one condition to another. Ideation, like the opening of the petals of the flower, represents a perpetual unfolding of things from within, and that in a mysterious way, forms are the constantly changing and improving symbols of greater and greater life release. Thus, everywhere in nature, things do not stand still. The grain of sand is hastening to become a star. The flower that grows in the field is growing up toward becoming a sun or a planet. Everything is growing toward a fuller expression of its own potential life. And this growth is God coming of age in its own creation. It is the infinite life becoming ever more obviously revealed, ever revealing more fully its incredible, limitless potential. Now, every creature that is passing through this vast period of evolution has certain limitations upon itself. It cannot receive or interpret energies beyond the general level of its attained vehicles of expression. Thus, man can grow within the gamut or range of man until finally he outgrows humanity. The animal can grow within the range of the animal kingdom until it also outgrows its animal kind. Growth at any time cannot be infinite or complete, for growth itself is an ever-flowing, and this process of ideation or release from within is causing life to build ever more noble mansions for the principle within itself. And these bodies, these houses of this growing life, are instruments for expression, for the release into tangible action of these pressures, these impulses, these instincts, these urges, which all life has locked within itself. So the ancients have this law of evolution, or the constant growth of things, an evolution theoretically beginning in God and ending in God, and passing in its middle distances through incredible diversities of development and structure. Everything hastening on. Life a procession going somewhere. Life never for a moment merely a diffusion going nowhere. For in the infinite will, the entire purpose of life is sustained by this law. This law is the instrument of that will, the law itself being the immediate vehicle of the divine purpose. The ancients then naturally assumed that this law was not only the first and primary, but that actually all other laws are parts of it. This law is never divided, it never forks into branches, nor are there other laws emerging around it. All other laws emerge from within it. They are specializations and differentiations of this law. For they answer the question, how? How this law will operate. But in the root of the law itself is the question, why? And that question lies in the divine will. Thus, all things in law are unfolded through the mystery of how this shall be accomplished. And out of the root law, or the great principle of evolution, there therefore come the trooping procession of other laws, laws which in their minor divisions are innumerable, like the twigs and leaves of a great tree, but in their principal trunks and branches they are few, each one clearly definable, although the manifestations and ramifications may transcend our understanding. The law of evolution, then, is the key for man to his own growth, the key to his own proper relationship with life, the key to the fact that never can he stand still. Never can he say, unto the passing hour, O stay, thou art so fair. Never can he pause, for in nature nothing stands still. He either moves forward by a perpetual impulse from within himself, or he retrogrades, or seems to fall backward, coming into contact violently with the flow of law, which, tossing him about, finally forces him back again into the natural stream of progress. He cannot survive resistance, nor can he be destroyed. He must inevitably float back into the pattern and go on, finding his security in the law and his misery in the efforts which he makes to break it. Evolution also gives a tremendous moral force to man. Evolution reveals to him, for example, that basically there are not many lives, but there is one life forever growing. Evolution makes possible the realization that the lives in all things are the life of God, thereby making reasonable, probable, and acceptable the great concepts of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. The realization of this law ends forever man's belief in his own uniqueness. Humanity is not something utterly and completely set apart. Humanity is a degree in the growth of God's. It is the degree in the tremendous motion of life. Plants, birds, animals, insects, flowers, even minerals, are also degrees in this motion of one life. Therefore, all things are bound together by one tremendous vital spark, and they are also bound together by one eternal need, the need to grow. And man has the privilege, as he becomes wiser and older, of helping life to grow and finding his full satisfaction in the service of life rather than in the exploitation and ravaging of life. Thus, unity of purpose becomes understandable, and the great principles of universal philosophy are made meaningful because man recognizes his unity with all that exists and his participation in the great pageantry of growth. It also tells us that we are here in this world now to grow. That growth must never pause, and that for man, growth lies in the direction of the improvement of the present instruments that he has. For by such improvement, he is able to release more and more of the divine content of his own nature. A man seeking to improve, improves not for himself, but in order that the universal life in him may be made more perfectly manifest. Thus man, trying to live better, is actually helping deity to be released into expression through action. Thus the individual, by his dedication to growth, serves not only himself, but the whole universal plan. And ignorance or indifference to growth is perhaps one of the gravest evils that man can permit to endure. So life, with its eternal growth, makes the individual's life rich who grows much. And growth is, of course, the general and gradual unfoldment of instruments of manifestation for mind, emotion, conscience, heart, soul, and spirit. These things coming into greater revelation through trained, refined, organized, and skilled personalities become able to reveal their own essential natures more completely. Now, out of this law, which is immutable, from which we cannot escape, and from which there is no end except fulfillment, a fulfillment so infinite and ultimate that we can scarcely dream of it, but a fulfillment that is not in itself the major consideration at the moment. That we will fulfill, we know in our faith. The immediate problem is the next step. What is now necessary to keep faith? For when we keep faith with the law, we keep the faith. We have no recourse beyond this. Now, out of this primary and eternal motion, the motion that sustains the whole cosmic chain of worlds, man recognizes a second law. Out of the first, related to it, but revealing its manifestation more expertly. As the Chinese say, each long journey begins with a single step. And this great journey of evolution is by a series of steps. Each step in itself perhaps not ultimate, not highly significant, but each step achieving its part of the journey. The steps are brief, faltering, and inconspicuous, but the journey is great and meaningful. And this law, then, which helps us to take the steps of the journey, helps us to walk along this great road of evolution that leads on beyond the stars and space. We call this law cause and effect. Cause and effect tells us to a great degree how we evolve and how the machinery of evolution comes to operate in the life of the individual. Cause and effect also has bearing upon one point, which is otherwise rather difficult. We know that man, at the beginning of his great evolutionary cycle, was in the greatest need of knowledge, and at that time he had the least. Just as the newborn child, in infancy, is in greatest need of orientation, and yet is least able to find its place in the world. So the law of cause and effect steps in and gives us the great formula of trial and error. Cause and effect gradually brings to our attention and to the attention of all life the growth or the motion of forever becoming is a series of related circumstances, and that these circumstances lead from an infinite primary cause which resides in the divine nature and terminate in an infinite ultimate result or effect which also rests in the divine nature. Therefore, all cause, life, is flowing into effect, living. And the relationships of these patterns become essential to our gradual enlightenment. By degrees, man learns how to grow. He learns through trial and error. He learns by doing and observing the consequences of things done. He also senses that the universe proceeds through a series of related causes and effects, each cause inevitably producing an effect consistent with itself, and each effect becoming in its own turn, by its own nature and substance, a new cause, which in turn leads inevitably to an effect. This goes on in an almost inconceivable cycle. And man has to gradually become aware that this pattern of cause and effect is valuable to him, not because it necessarily merely relates to his own moral conduct, but because it explains to him the mystery of antecedent causes, proving gradually to him that everything that exists now has had a previous existence in cause, and that any circumstance that arises must be the consistent consequence of action. Therefore, we may call cause and effect on another level action and reaction. We may say that everything that exists bears witness to a reason for its own existence, and that that a reason is consistent and adequate, and that there can never be an effect inconsistent with its cause, or a cause that does not produce a consistent effect. This takes what we like to call luck, chance, providence, accident, out of our consciousness as factors in existence. And it is very good for us that we should lose these concepts. For as long as man believes that he lives in an unlawful universe, or a universe of accidents, he can never develop an adequate moral philosophy. He can never recognize personal responsibility unless he realizes that his action must have reaction. He can never fully integrate himself into the concept of a vast integrated sphere unless he recognizes his own existence both as an effect and a cause. That he is here as a species, as a collective, because he is the next step in something. Because in his turn, from himself will come the next step in something. And each stage or development of things has its inevitable, unchangeable patterns. And also that once causes have been set in motion, they cannot be frustrated. They must move toward their inevitable consequences. And man, nature, or space, unfolding according to the laws of cause and effect, can never invalidate any of the procedures which have already been set in motion. Consequently, we have a new code of adjustment necessary, namely that all life must learn to cheerfully abide by the consequences of the causations which it has set in motion. The deity itself must abide by the effect created by its own primary creative impulse. Once creation begins, once the great primal cause, the fiat, is spoken or sounded, once the Logos brings forth the worlds, from that time on, the Logos, the gods and the powers, are subjected to their own laws. Deity is not a being outside of law, but is the power of law itself, and must forever abide by the principles which it has established. Man must therefore learn that the lawmaker must keep his own laws, and that no individual can escape from the lawful consequences of things done or things undone. The law of cause and effect has also some rather benevolent promises about it. It tells us that no thing in itself good can be without consequence. That the universe, by its own nature, is good. Being the product of the divine will, it is divine. Therefore, the ultimate effect of the creation as it unfolds must be good because its cause is good. Therefore, evil can never vanquish good because it can never overwhelm the great, eternal, and good cause which set all things in motion and must bring a harvest according to its own nature. Now man, in his own limited way, has always attempted to resist the great laws of cause and effect. He has attempted to reap where he has not sown. He has attempted to escape from the consequences of his own actions and conduct. But while he believes he can do this, he is under a delusion. And because of this delusion, we've had dictators and autocrats and despotisms. We have had innumerable afflictions of mankind by man, simply because we do not believe the justice of universal procedure. Yet one by one, the tyrants have fallen. One by one, the despots have gone their way one by one, the pomp and circumstances vanish from our sight. Only the law remains, and only the simple, natural obedience gives the security that man requires. Now, the law of cause and effect also tells us that from first cause, all causation must have in its nature necessity. Therefore, the law of cause and effect is related to the principle of necessity. And the great sphere of cause and effect is called the sphere of necessity. All things grow. Growth is necessary. All things grow slowly, often painfully, because of inability to fully understand. But man grows victoriously because he gradually learns to understand causes. He learns little by little to protect himself against forces and circumstances which might be destructive to him. He learns how to estimate the results of things. He learns thrift and providence this way. He learns the importance of good temper and a good disposition. He learns ultimately that if he is friendly, he will have friends. If he is unfriendly, he will be friendless. These things he learns. He learns sometimes the hard way. Often he resists and rebels. But ultimately, the grand pattern of law must become apparent to him. And he must realize that he is moving again within an immutable structure. A structure so great and so universal and so ultimately perfect that there can be no resistance to it that is successful. Now, the law of cause and effect operates again to another law, which emerges out of its own nature and becomes important to us. Got a little list of them here because I want to get all seven in before the time is up. Once in a while, you know, we skimp a little on the last one of something, and that we don't want to do tonight. Now, the law of cause and effect indicates or suggests a kind of balancing, so that we come out of the law of cause and effect with the next law, which is the law of polarity, which leads ultimately to the establishment of the principle of equilibrium. Now, everything in nature, like the celestial crab, which crawls forward with a strange and angular motion, everything in nature moves according to and functions by the principle of polarity. In a way, cause and effect is polarity. Cause being a positive pole, effect being a negative pole. Here we have electricity and magnetism. We have dynamic and static everywhere. We have the poles of a battery. Everywhere in life, we find the problem of polarity operating. And polarity becomes important to us in many, many respects. Because man, through the gradual understanding of the law of polarity, has a gradual tendency to correct his own tendency to be lopsided, which becomes a very serious thing. Now, of course, when we look in the mirror, it may not be noticeable. But at the same time, in our conduct, it usually is. Polarity means that most forms of life oscillate or move between two poles, alternating between positive and negative. Creation, for example, moves between two vast poles, manifestation and obscuration, or the day and night of the gods. Every period of manifestation must be followed by a period of repose. There is a great respiration, the breath of Shiva, the outbreathing of worlds in the great dawn of things, the inbreathing of worlds at the end of things. There is the ebbing and the flowing of the tide, waking and sleeping, life and death, winter and summer. Everywhere in nature we have these polarities, which as the seasons do in the earth. These result in the gradual ripening of things from their seed to their harvest. And without these alternations, without these constant alterations of polarities, the magnificent framework of law could not accomplish its perfect work. Now, in this great pattern of polarization, as we care to call it, we see innumerable things of value to ourselves here and now. One of the most common polarizations we recognize is the polarization of generation. We know also the famous reference made by Plato in his study of the great Platonic year, in which he describes that the great 25,000-year cycle resulting from the precession of the equinoxes is divided into two periods, or halves, one of which was a period of fertility and the other of sterility. In periods of fertility, great cultures flourish. Wisdom comes forth. Art and beauty are manifested. In periods of sterility, men lose a certain amount of internal vitality. Materialism dominates. Men cease to have their ideals. The earth is impoverished and no longer produces as good grain and food. And cultures have a tendency to languish for lack of both spiritual and material nutrition. Here is again action and repose. So as we have in cause and effect action and reaction, here on the laws of polarity, we have action and repose. Things moving always by certain effort, accompanied again by certain periods of rest. And we also find that in nature, everything is generated through polarization. And at the same time, there is a constant motion of life away from these polarized opposites toward the mysterious point of equilibrium. Now, we have considerable philosophical discussion relating to this issue, and it becomes more involved than we perhaps realize. Equilibrium is, to the average individual's concept, an idea of the suspension of motion. Today, for example, we are proud of the fact that we are very highly polarized. We say that an individual is very enthusiastic at one moment and utterly down in the dumps the next, is really living life to its fullest. He's having his good days and his bad days, but he's certainly having a lot of excitement. Whereas if we find an individual who is by nature rather quiet and composed, we suspected him of being dead while still he is alive. If he doesn't get angry, we think he is timid. If he isn't jealous of somebody, he doesn't care for anyone. And so we make gradually a great deal out of this polarized extremism of our conduct. We had a lady in not long ago who was quite convinced her husband didn't love her, because for 5 years he had shown no sign of jealousy. It was just something she could hardly endure. She had no complaint. She had no reason to think he didn't. But he just wasn't jealous. That was a bad sign all by itself. So we have people who honestly believe that unless we are really quite tempestuous in our attitudes, that we haven't any. Or if we don't take violent sides in arguments and debates, we're not patriotic. If we're not for our candidate and against all the others, we have no political vision. And of course, occasionally we come to a sort of negative equilibrium in which they decide none of the candidates is any good. This, of course, is also considered bad because that is defeatism. It sounds as though we are trying to escape a nasty decision, and we are. But we have come to think of excess as being an indication of life, moderation as an indication of death. And our psychologists are feeding us some of that thinking these days. And furthermore, they are reminding us that one of the most common symptoms of paranoia is great periods of exhilaration followed by great periods of depression. So we have our choice. If we have an exhilaration and depression, we are admired by our friends and accused of being paranoiac by our psychologists. Actually, nature is moving toward equilibrium. But equilibrium is not something that is going to sneak up on us unaware. Equilibrium does not mean that someday, whether we will or not, the pendulum is going to stop in the middle. Equilibrium is the most difficult thing in nature to attain. Because equilibrium is immortality. Equilibrium is a deathless state. It is a state in which excess ceases. All immoderations come to an end. And in the complete suspension of polarization, we attain what the Buddhist terms nirvana. For nirvana is the end of the imbalance of conflict in the compound personality of the human being. In the universe, equilibrium is also the end of conflict. But conflict cannot end until the conflicting factors have been resolved. And these conflicting factors are nothing more or less than the unfinishedness in things. Everything that is imperfect is unbalanced. And consequently, only perfection, which is a total equilibrium in the term of plus, can have complete equilibrium. Absolute negative equilibrium, or an equilibrium in the minus, is total negation. And total negation we cannot find either. Although we find phases of negation which may nearly approach it in the purposeless, meaningless, ambitionless primitive. The human being whose desires are practically nil, whose wishes are comparatively few, and who therefore lives in what we term an ideal state of not wanting. He not only does not want, he has never learned to want. Man, in turn, must gradually want, outgrow wanting, and learn not to want. But there's a great deal of difference between never knowing and outgrowing. So motion is really through polarization to ultimate equilibrium. And we are reminded, of course, of the famous line in the Zohar, the unbalanced forces must perish in the void. Everything that is unbalanced must cease, must ultimately be dissolved in balance. Almost every negative emotion or negative attitude that we have is an unbalance. Therefore, hate is an unbalance. Fear is an unbalance. Anything which causes the individual to depart from his own center and become hopelessly involved in circumferential problems results in unbalance. Remember in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the soul of the deceased is weighed against the feather of Maat. If the scales balance, the soul may pass on into the blessed land. Therefore, balance, which is the great lesson of equilibrium, which in turn arises from man's experience of polarity. This procedure, through experience, brings man to one of the great discoveries, one of the great revelations which sustain him and strengthen him for his spiritual adventure. Now, polarization affects us in many other ways. It gives us contrasts. Now, without contrasts, the lights and shadows of a picture, we call the picture very flat. Therefore, we believe in lights and shadows. But wherever we believe in them, we must endure them. And where we believe in lights and shadows, we must believe in pain and pleasure. We must believe in hope and despair. We must believe in gain and loss. And polarity tells us that we can never have a gain without a loss. And we can never have a loss without a gain. So over the inevitable, why should we grieve? Every individual who possesses must, to one way or another, be relieved of his possession. Any individual who gives up will in some strange way regain that which he has given away. The law of polarity is constantly operating in every department of our life. And the more extreme our attitudes become, the more vicious the swing of the pendulum. Thus the miser, who has become extreme in his cupidity, will experience often the greatest tragedy in the loss of his wealth. Always where the individual is unbalanced, viciously, or extensively, or intensively, his problems are correspondingly modified. Great attachments mean great loss. Great attainments mean constant vigilance in the protection of a reputation so gained. Everything has its price, and this is another form of polarity. And the individual, therefore, attempting to escape from the vicious swings of this pendulum, is led toward moderation of conduct, which was the great Socratic virtue. Socrates says, in all things, not too much. And the golden mean, the concept that moderation releases the mind and the heart and the soul from unreasonable attachments and frees the mind, heart, and soul for the contemplation of realities. Thus, immoderation is not only a pernicious practice as far as the general life is concerned, but it dooms the individual to the perpetuation of ignorance. For that which exists in an immoderate state is in the poorest condition to learn. Moderation leads to contemplative freedom. The individual who is not the victim of his own intensities has therefore the tranquility for contemplation, for reflection, for meditation, for natural and detached observation of values. Plato declared that he was born into this world in the profession of an observer. A man gradually has to learn by becoming observant. To the degree that he is overly personal or overly attached, he is not observant and cannot be. Because when he is deformed in his judgment by the intemperances of his conduct, he is unable to estimate the values of things. Those things which he likes become increasingly unreally valuable. Those things which he does not like are not recognized for their full value. Therefore, like and dislike become polarities by which the truth is always obscured.